Disc 5.
The Herb of Death. Mrs. Bantry looked around her dinner table at her guests. Miss Marple wore black lace mittens, and an old lace fichu was draped round her shoulders. Sir Henry Clithering, ex-commissioner of Scotland Yard, had suggested inviting Miss Marple after telling how the white-haired old lady outdid everyone in the game of crime-solving. Mrs. Bantry's gaze fixed on her broad-shouldered husband as he sat talking to Jane Hellyer, the beautiful and popular actress. And there was also the elderly Dr. Lloyd. Sir Henry interrupted her thoughts. "Now then, Mrs. B," he said. Mrs. Bantry looked at him in cold reproof. "I've told you before that I will not be called Mrs. B. It's not dignified. Scheherazade, then. And even less am I what's her name? I never can tell a story properly. Well, ask Arthur if you don't believe me." "You're quite good at the facts, Dolly," said Colonel Bantry, "but poor at the embroidery." "That's just it," said Mrs. Bantry. She flapped the bulb catalogue she was holding on the table in front of her. "I've been listening to you all, and I don't know how you do it. He said, she said, you wondered, they thought, everyone implied. Well, I just couldn't, and here it is. And besides, I don't know anything to tell a story about." "We can't believe that, Mrs. Bantry," said Dr. Lloyd. He shook his grey head in mocking disbelief. Old Miss Marple said in her gentle voice, "Surely, dear." Mrs. Bantry continued obstinately to shake her head. "You don't know how banal my life is, what with the servants and the difficulties of getting scullery maids, and just going to town for clothes and dentists and Ascot, which Arthur hates. And then the garden." "Ah," said Dr. Lloyd, "the garden. We all know where your heart lies, Mrs. Bantry." "Must be nice to have a garden," said Jane Hellyer, the beautiful young actress. "That is, if you haven't got to dig or to get your hands messed up. I'm ever so fond of flowers." "The garden," said Sir Henry. "Can't we take that as a starting point? Come, Mrs. B., the poisoned bulb, the deadly daffodils, the herb of death." "Now it's odd your saying that," said Mrs. Bantry. "You've just reminded me. Arthur, do you remember that business at Clodderham Court? You know, old Sir Ambrose Bursey. Do you remember what a curtly, charming old man we thought him?" "Oh, why, of course, yes, that was a strange business. Go ahead, Dolly." "Well, you'd better tell it, dear." "Nonsense, go ahead. Must paddle your own canoe. I did my bit just now." Mrs. Bantry drew a deep breath. She clasped her hands, and her face registered complete mental anguish. She spoke rapidly and fluently. "Well, there's really not much to tell. The herb of death, that's what put it into my head, though in my own mind I called it sage and onions." "Sage and onions?" asked Dr. Lloyd. Mrs. Bantry nodded. "That was how it happened, you see," she explained. "We were staying, Arthur and I, with Sir Ambrose Bursey at Clodderham Court, and one day, by mistake, though very stupidly, I've always thought, a lot of foxglove's leaves were picked with the sage. The ducks for dinner that night were stuffed with it, and everyone was very ill, and one poor girl, Sir Ambrose Ward, died of it." She stopped. "Dear, dear," said Miss Marple, "how very tragic. Wasn't it?" "Well," said Sir Henry, "what next?" "There isn't any next," said Mrs. Bantry, "that's all." Everyone gasped. Though warned beforehand, they had not expected quite such brevity as this. "But, my dear lady," remonstrated Sir Henry, "it can't be all. What you've related is a tragic occurrence, but not in any sense of the word a problem." "Well, of course there's some more," said Mrs. Bantry, "but if I were to tell you, you'd know what it was." She looked defiantly round the assembly and said plaintively, "I told you I couldn't dress things up and make it sound properly like a story ought to do." "Aha," said Sir Henry. He sat up in his chair and adjusted an eyeglass. "Really, you know, Scheherazade, this is most refreshing. Our ingenuity is challenged. I'm not so sure you haven't done it on purpose, to stimulate our curiosity. A few brisk rounds of 20 questions is indicated, I think. Miss Marple, will you begin?" "I'd like to know something about the cook," said Miss Marple. "She must have been a very stupid woman, or else very inexperienced." She was just very stupid, said Mrs. Bantry. She cried a great deal afterwards, and said the leaves had been picked and brought into her as sage. And how was she to know? Not one who thought for herself, said Miss Marple. Probably an elderly woman, and I dare say a very good cook. Oh, excellent, said Mrs. Bantry. Your turn, Miss Hellyer, said Sir Henry. Oh, you mean to ask a question? There was a pause while Jane pondered. Finally, she said helplessly, Really? I don't know what to ask. Her beautiful eyes looked appealingly at Sir Henry. Why not the cast, Miss Hellyer? He suggested, smiling. Jane still looked puzzled. Characters in order of their appearance, said Sir Henry gently. Oh, yes, said Jane, that's a good idea. Mrs. Bantry began briskly to tick people off on her fingers. Sir Ambrose, Sylvia Keane, that's the girl who died. A friend of hers was staying there, Maud Y, one of those dark, ugly girls who managed to make an effect somehow. I never know how they do it. Then there was a Mr. Curl who had come down to discuss books with Sir Ambrose, you know, rare books, queer old things in Latin, all musty parchment. There was Jerry Lorimer. He was a kind of next-door neighbour. His place, Fairleys, joined Sir Ambrose's estate. And there was Mrs. Carpenter, one of those middle-aged pussies who all seemed to manage to dig themselves in comfortably somewhere. She was by way of being a dame de compagnie to Sylvia, I suppose. If it's my turn, said Sir Henry, I suppose it is, as I'm sitting next to Miss Hellyer, I want a good deal. I want a short verbal portrait, please, Mrs. Bantry, of all the foregoing. Oh, Mrs. Bantry hesitated. Sir Ambrose now, continued Sir Henry, start with him. What was he like? Oh, he was a very distinguished-looking old man, and not so really very old, not more than 60, I suppose, but he was very delicate. He had a weak heart. He could never go upstairs, and he had to have a lift put in, so that made him seem older than he was. Very charming manners. Courtly, that's the word that describes him best. You never saw him ruffled or upset. He had beautiful white hair and a particularly charming voice. Good, said Sir Henry. I see Sir Ambrose. Now, the girl Sylvia, what did you say her name was? Sylvia Keane. She was pretty, really very pretty. Fair haired, you know, and a lovely skin. Not perhaps very clever, in fact rather stupid. Oh, come, Dolly, protested her husband. Arthur, of course, wouldn't think so, said Mrs. Bantry dryly, but she was stupid. She really never said anything worth listening to. "'One of the most graceful creatures I ever saw,' said Colonel Bantry warmly. "'See her playing tennis. Charming, simply charming, and she was full of fun. "'Most amusing little thing, and such a pretty way with her. "'I bet the young fellows all thought so.' "'That's just where you're wrong,' said Mrs. Bantry. "'Youth, as such, has no charms for young men nowadays. "'It's only old duffers like you, Arthur, who sit maundering on about young girls.' "'Being young's no good,' said Jane. "'You've got to have S.A.' "'What,' said Miss Marple, "'is S.A.' "'Sex appeal,' said Jane. "'Ah, yes,' said Miss Marple, "'what in my day they used to call "'having the come-hither in your eye.' "'Not a bad description,' said Sir Henry. "'The dame de compagnie you described, I think, "'as a pussy, Mrs. Bantry.' "'I didn't mean a cat, you know,' said Mrs. Bantry. "'It's quite different.' Just a big, soft, white, purry person. Always very sweet. That's what Adelaide Carpenter was like. What sort of aged woman? Oh, I should say 40-ish. She'd been there some time, ever since Sylvia was 11, I believe. Very tactful person, one of these widows left in unfortunate circumstances, with plenty of aristocratic relations, but no ready cash. I didn't like her myself, but then I never do like people with very long white hands, and I don't like pussies. Mr. Curl? Oh, one of those elderly stooping men. There are so many of them about, you'd hardly know one from the other. He showed enthusiasm when talking about his musty books, but not at any other time. I don't think Sir Ambrose knew him very well. And Jerry next door? A really charming boy. He was engaged to Sylvia. That's what made it so sad. Now, I wonder, began Miss Marple, and then stopped. What? Nothing, dear. Sir Henry looked at the old lady curiously. Then he said thoughtfully, So this young couple were engaged. Had they been engaged long? About a year, Sir Ambrose had opposed the engagement on the plea that Sylvia was too young, but after a year's engagement he had given in, and the marriage was to have taken place quite soon. Ah, had the young lady any property? Next to nothing, bare 100 or 200 a year. No rat in that hole, Clithering, said Colonel Bantry, and laughed. It's the doctor's turn to ask a question, said Sir Henry. I stand down. My curiosity is mainly professional, said Dr. Lloyd. I should like to know what medical evidence was given at the inquest, that is, if our hostess remembers, or indeed if she knows. I know roughly, said Mrs. Bantry. Was poisoning by digitalis. Is that right? Dr. Lloyd nodded. The active principle of the foxglove, digitalis, acts on the heart. Indeed, it's a very valuable drug in some forms of heart trouble. Very curious case altogether. I would never have believed that eating a preparation of foxglove leaves could possibly result fatally. These ideas of eating poisonous leaves and berries are very much exaggerated. Very few people realize that the vital principle, or alkaloid, has to be extracted with much care and preparation. Mrs. MacArthur sent some special bulbs round to Mrs. Toomey the other day, said Miss Marple, and Mrs. Toomey's cook mistook them for onions, and all the Toomeys were very ill indeed. But they didn't die of it, said Dr. Lloyd. No, they didn't die of it, admitted Miss Marple. A girl I knew died of ptomaine poisoning, said Jane Hellyer. We must get on with investigating the crime, said Sir Henry. Crime, said Jane startled. I thought it was an accident. If it were an accident, said Sir Henry gently, I do not think Mrs. Bantry would have told us this story. No, as I read it, this was an accident only in appearance. Behind it is something more sinister. I remember a case. Various guests in a house party were chatting after dinner. The walls were adorned with all kinds of old-fashioned weapons. Entirely as a joke, one of the party seized an ancient horse pistol and pointed it at another man, pretending to fire it. The pistol was loaded and went off, killing the man. We had to ascertain in that case, first, who had secretly prepared and loaded the pistol, and secondly, who had so led and directed the conversation that that final bit of horseplay resulted. For the man who had fired the pistol was entirely innocent. Seems to me we have much the same problem here. Those digitalis leaves were deliberately mixed with the sage, knowing what the result would be. Since we exonerate the cook, we do exonerate the cook, don't we? The question arises, who picked the leaves and delivered them to the kitchen? That's easily answered, said Mrs. Bantry. At least that last part of it is. It was Sylvia herself who took the leaves into the kitchen. It was part of her daily job to gather things like salad or herbs, bunches of young carrots, all that sort of thing that gardeners never pick right. They hate giving you anything young and tender. They wait for them to be fine specimens. Sylvia and Mrs. Carpenter used to see to a lot of these things themselves, and there was foxglove actually growing all amongst the sage in one corner. So the mistake was quite natural. But did Sylvia actually pick them herself? That nobody ever knew. It was assumed so. Assumptions, said Sir Henry, are dangerous things. But I do know that Mrs. Carpenter didn't pick them, said Mrs. Bantry, because, as it happened, she was walking with me on the terrace that morning. We went out there after breakfast. It was unusually nice and warm for early spring. Sylvia went alone down into the garden. But later I saw her walking arm in arm with Maud Wye. So they were great friends, were they? Asked Miss Marple. Yes, said Mrs. Bantry. She seemed as though about to say something, but didn't do so. Had she been staying there long? Asked Miss Marple. About a fortnight, said Mrs. Bantry. There was a note of trouble in her voice. You didn't like Miss Wye, suggested Sir Henry. Well, I did. That's just it. I did. The trouble in her voice had grown to distress. You're keeping something back, Mrs. Bantry, said Sir Henry accusingly. I wondered just now, said Miss Marple, but I didn't like to go on. When did you wonder? When you said that the young people were engaged, you said that that was what made it so sad. But if you know what I mean, your voice didn't sound right when you said it. Not convincing, you know. What a dreadful person you are, said Mrs. Bantry. You always seem to know. Yes, I was thinking of something, but I don't really know whether I ought to say it or not. You must say it, said Sir Henry. Whatever your scruples, it mustn't be kept back. Well, it was just this, said Mrs. Bantry. One evening, in fact the very evening before the tragedy, I happened to go out on the terrace before dinner. The window in the drawing-room was open, and as it chanced, I saw Jerry Lorimer and Maud Wye. He was, kissing her. Of course, I didn't know whether it was just a sort of chance affair, or whether... Well, I mean, one can't tell. I knew Sir Ambrose never had really liked Jerry Lorimer, so perhaps he knew he was that kind of young man. But one thing I am sure of, that girl Maud Wye was really fond of him. You'd only to see her looking at him when she was off guard. And I think, too, that they were really better suited than he and Sylvia were. "I'm going to ask a question quickly before Miss Marple can," said Sir Henry. "I want to know whether, after the tragedy, Jerry Lorimer married Maud Wye." "Yes," said Mrs. Bantry, "he did, 6 months afterwards." "Oh, Scheherazade, Scheherazade," said Sir Henry, "to think of the way you told us this story at first. Bare bones indeed, and to think of the amount of flesh we're finding on them now." "Don't speak so girlishly," said Mrs. Bantry. "And don't use the word flesh. Vegetarians always do. They say, 'I never eat flesh,' in a way that puts you right off your nice little beefsteak. Mr. Curl was a vegetarian. He used to eat some peculiar stuff that looked like bran for breakfast. Those elderly stooping men with beards are often faddy. They have patent kinds of underwear, too." "What on earth, Dolly," said her husband, "do you know about Mr. Curl's underwear?" "Nothing," said Mrs. Bantry with dignity. "I was just making a guess." "I'll amend my former statement," said Sir Henry. "I'll say instead that the cast of characters in your problem is very interesting. I'm beginning to see them all. Eh, Miss Marple?" "Human nature is always interesting, Sir Henry, and it's curious to see how certain types always tend to act in exactly the same way." "Two women and a man," said Sir Henry. "The old eternal human triangle. Is that the base of our problem here? I rather fancy it is." Dr. Lloyd cleared his throat. I've been thinking," he said rather diffidently. "Do you say, Mrs. Bantry, that you yourself were ill?" "Was I not? So was Arthur, so was everyone." "That's just it. Everyone," said the doctor. "You see what I mean? In Sir Henry's story, which he told us just now, one man shot another. He didn't have to shoot the whole room full." "I don't understand," said Jane. "Who shot who?" "I'm saying that whoever planned this thing went about it very curiously, either with a blind belief in chance or else with an absolutely reckless disregard for human life. I can hardly believe there is a man capable of deliberately poisoning 8 people with the object of removing one amongst them." "I see your point," said Sir Henry thoughtfully. "I confess I ought to have thought of that." "And mightn't he have poisoned himself too?" asked Jane. "Was anyone absent from dinner that night?" asked Miss Marple. Mrs. Bantry shook her head. "Everyone was there." "Except Mr. Lorimer, I suppose, my dear. He wasn't staying in the house, was he?" "No, but he was dining there that evening," said Mrs. Bantry. "Oh," said Miss Marple in a changed voice. "Oh, that makes all the difference in the world." She frowned vexedly to herself. "I've been very stupid," she murmured. "Very stupid indeed."
"I confess your point worries me, Lloyd," said Sir Henry. "How ensure that the girl, and the girl only, should get a fatal dose?" "You can't," said the doctor. "That brings me to the point I'm going to make. Supposing the girl was not the intended victim after all?"
"What?"
"In all cases of food poisoning, the result is very uncertain. Several people share a dish. What happens? One or two are slightly ill, 2 more, say, are seriously indisposed. One dies. That's the way of it. There's no certainty anywhere. But there are cases where another factor might enter in. Digitalin is a drug that acts directly on the heart. As I've told you, it's prescribed in certain cases. Now, there was one person in that house who suffered from a heart complaint. Suppose he was the victim selected. What would not be fatal to the rest would be fatal to him, or so the murderer might reasonably suppose. That the thing turned out differently is only proof of what I was saying just now, the uncertainty and unreliability of the effect of drugs on human beings." "Sir Ambrose," said Sir Henry, "you think he was the person aimed at?"
"Yes, yes, and the girl's death was a mistake."
"Who got his money after he was dead?" asked Jane.
"A very sound question, Miss Hellyer. One of the first we always ask in my late profession," said Sir Henry.
"Sir Ambrose had a son," said Mrs. Bantry slowly. He'd quarrelled with him many years previously. The boy was wild, I believe, still it was not in Sir Ambrose's power to disinherit him. Clotherham Court was entailed. Martin Bursey succeeded to the title and estate. There was, however, a good deal of other property that Sir Ambrose could leave as he chose, and that he left to his ward Sylvia. I know this because Sir Ambrose died less than a year after the events I'm telling you of, and he had not troubled to make a new will after Sylvia's death. I think the money went to the Crown. Or perhaps it was to his son as next of kin. I don't really remember. So it was only to the interest of a son who wasn't there, and the girl who died herself to make away with him, said Sir Henry thoughtfully. That doesn't seem very promising.
Didn't the other woman get anything? Asked Jane, the one Mrs. Bantry calls the pussy woman.
She wasn't mentioned in the will, said Mrs. Bantry.
Miss Marple, you're not listening, said Sir Henry. You're somewhere far away.
Well, I was thinking of old Mr. Badger, the chemist, said Miss Marple. He had a very young housekeeper, young enough to be not only his daughter, but his granddaughter. Not a word to anyone, and his family, a lot of nephews and nieces, full of expectations. And when he died, would you believe it, he'd been secretly married to her for 2 years. Of course, Mr. Badger was a chemist and a very rude, common old man as well. Sir Ambrose Bursier was a very courtly gentleman, so Mrs. Bantley says, but for all that, human nature is much the same everywhere. There was a pause. Sir Henry looked very hard at Miss Marple, who looked back at him with gently quizzical blue eyes. Jane Hellyer broke the silence.
"Was this Mrs. Carpenter good-looking?" she asked.
"Yes, in a very quiet way, nothing startling." "She had a very sympathetic voice," said Colonel Bantry.
"Purring, that's what I called it," said Mrs. Bantry, "purring. You'll be called a cat yourself one of these days, Dolly."
"I like being a cat in my home circle," said Mrs. Bantry. "I don't much like women anyway, and you know it. I like men and flowers."
"Excellent taste," said Sir Henry, "especially in putting men first."
"That was tact," said Mrs. Bantry.
"Well, now, what about my little problem? I've been quite fair, I think. Arthur, don't you think I've been fair?"
"Yes, my dear, I don't think there'll be any inquiry into the running by the stewards of the Jockey Club."
"First boy," said Mrs. Bantry, pointing a finger at Sir Henry. "I'm going to be long-winded, because, you see, I haven't really got any feeling of certainty about the matter. First, Sir Ambrose, well, he wouldn't take such an original method of committing suicide, and on the other hand, he certainly had nothing to gain by the death of his ward. Exit Sir Ambrose. Mr. Curl, no motive for death of girl? If Sir Ambrose was intended victim, he might possibly have purloined a rare manuscript or two that no one else would miss. Very thin, most unlikely. So I think that in spite of Mrs. Bantry's suspicions as to his underclothing, Mr. Curl is cleared. Miss Y. Motive for death of Sir Ambrose? None. Motive for death of Sylvia? Pretty strong. She wanted Sylvia's young man, and wanted him rather badly, from Mrs. Bantry's account. She was with Sylvia that morning in the garden, so had opportunity to pick leaves. No, we can't dismiss Miss Y so easily. Young Lorimer? He's got a motive in either case. If he gets rid of his sweetheart, he can marry the other girl. Still, seems a bit drastic to kill her. What's a broken engagement in these days? If Sir Ambrose dies, he will marry a rich girl instead of a poor one. That might be important or not. Depends on his financial position. If I find that his estate was heavily mortgaged, and that Mrs. Bantry deliberately withheld the fact from us, I shall claim a foul. Now, Mrs. Carpenter, you know I've suspicions of Mrs. Carpenter. Those white hands, for one thing, and her excellent alibi at the time the herbs were picked. I always distrust alibis. And I've got another reason for suspecting her, which I shall keep to myself. Still, on the whole, if I've got to plump, I shall plump for Miss Maud Y, because there's more evidence against her than anyone else.
"Next boy," said Mrs. Bantry, and pointing at Dr. Lloyd. "I think you're wrong, Slithering, in sticking to the theory that the girl's death was meant. I'm convinced that the murderer intended to do away with Sir Ambrose. I don't think that young Lorimer had the necessary knowledge. I'm inclined to believe that Mrs. Carpenter was the guilty party. She'd been a long time with the family, and knew all about the state of Sir Ambrose's health, and could easily arrange for this girl Sylvia, who, you said yourself, was rather stupid, to pick the right leaves. Motive, I confess, I don't see, but I hazard the guess that Sir Ambrose had at one time made a will at which she was mentioned. That's the best I can do." Mrs. Bantry's pointing finger went on to Jane Hillier. "I don't know what to say," said Jane, "except this. Why shouldn't the girl herself have done it? She took the leaves into the kitchen, after all. And you say Sir Ambrose had been sticking out against her marriage. If he died, she'd get the money and be able to marry at once. She'd know just as much about Sir Ambrose's health as Mrs. Carpenter would." Mrs. Bantry's finger came slowly round Miss Marple. "Now then, schoolmarm," she said. "Sir Henry has put it all very clearly indeed," said Miss Marple, "and Dr. Lloyd was so right in what he said, but between them they seem to have made things so very clear. Only I don't think Dr. Lloyd quite realized one aspect of what he said. You see, not being Sir Ambrose's medical adviser, he couldn't know just what kind of heart trouble Sir Ambrose had, could he?"
"I don't quite see what you mean, Miss Marple," said Dr. Lloyd.
"Well, you're assuming, aren't you, that Sir Ambrose had the kind of heart the digitalian would affect adversely? But there's nothing to prove that so. It might be just the other way about."
"The other way about?"
"Yes. You did say that it was often prescribed for heart trouble."
"Even then, Miss Marple, I don't see what that leads to."
"Well, it would mean that he would have digitalin in his possession quite naturally, without having to account for it. What I'm trying to say, I always express myself so badly, is this. Supposing you wanted to poison anyone with a fatal dose of digitalis, wouldn't the simplest and easiest way be to arrange for everyone to be poisoned, actually, by digitalin leaves? It wouldn't be fatal in anyone else's case, of course, but no one would be surprised at one victim because, as Dr. Lloyd said, these things are so uncertain. No one would be likely to ask whether the girl had actually had a fatal dose of infusion of digitalis or something of that kind. He might have put it in a cocktail or in her coffee or even made her drink it quite simply as a tonic."
"You mean Sir Ambrose poisoned his ward, the charming girl whom he loved?"
"That's just it," said Miss Marple, "like Mr. Badger and his young housekeeper. Don't tell me it's absurd for a man of 60 to fall in love with a girl of 20. It happens every day, and I dare say with an old autocrat like Sir Ambrose it might take him queerly. These things become a madness sometimes. He couldn't bear the thought of her getting married, did his best to oppose it, and failed. His mad jealousy became so great that he preferred killing her to letting her go to young Lorimer. He must have thought of it some time beforehand, because that foxglove seed would have to be sown among the sage. He'd pick it himself when the time came and send into the kitchen with it. It's horrible to think of, but I suppose we must take as merciful a view of it as we can. Gentlemen of that age are sometimes very peculiar indeed where young girls are concerned. Our last organist... but there, I mustn't talk scandal."
"Mrs. Bantry," said Sir Henry, "is this so?"
Mrs. Bantry nodded.
"Yes, I had no idea of it. Never dreamt of the thing being anything but an accident. Then after Sir Ambrose's death, I got a letter. He'd left directions to send it to me. He told me the truth in it. I don't know why, but he and I always got on very well together."
In the momentary silence, she seemed to feel an unspoken criticism and went on hastily, "Well, you think I'm betraying a confidence, but that isn't so. I've changed all the names. He wasn't really called Sir Ambrose Bursey. Didn't you see how Arthur stared stupidly when I said that name to him? He didn't understand at first. I've changed everything. It's like they say in magazines and in the beginning of books. All the characters in this story are purely fictitious. You'll never know who they really are."
The Affair at the Bungalow.
"I've thought of something," said Jane Hillier.
Her beautiful face was lit up with the confident smile of a child expecting approbation. It was a smile such as moved audiences nightly in London, and which had made the fortunes of photographers. "It happened," she went on carefully, "to a friend of mine." Everyone made encouraging but slightly hypocritical noises. Colonel Bantry, Mrs. Bantry, Sir Henry Clithering, Dr. Lloyd, and old Miss Marple were one and all convinced that Jane's friend was Jane herself. She would have been quite incapable of remembering or taking an interest in anything affecting anyone else. "My friend," went on Jane, "I won't mention her name, was an actress, a very well-known actress." No one expressed surprise. Sir Henry Clithering thought to himself, "Now I wonder how many sentences it'll be before she forgets to keep up the fiction and says I instead of she. "My friend was on tour in the provinces. This was a year or two ago. I suppose I better not give the name of the place. It was a riverside town, not very far from London. I'll call it..." She paused, her brows perplexed in thought. The invention of even a simple name appeared to be too much for her. Sir Henry came to the rescue. "Shall we call it Riverbury?" he suggested gravely. "Oh, yes, that would do splendidly. Riverbury, I'll remember that. Well, as I say, my friend was at Riverbury with her company, and a very curious thing happened." She puckered her brows again. "It's very difficult," she said plaintively, "to say just what you want. One gets things mixed up and tells the wrong thing first." "You're doing it beautifully," said Dr. Lloyd encouragingly. "Go on." "Well, this curious thing happened. My friend was sent forward to the police station, and she went. It seemed there had been a burglary at a riverside bungalow, and they'd arrested a young man, and he told a very odd story, and so they sent for her. She'd never been to a police station before, but they were very nice to her. Very nice indeed."
"They would be, I'm sure," said Sir Henry.
"The sergeant, I think it was a sergeant, or it may have been an inspector, gave her a chair and explained things, and of course I saw at once that it was some mistake."
"Ah," thought Sir Henry, "aye, here we are, I thought as much."
"My friend said so," continued Jane, serenely unconscious of her self-betrayal. "She explained that she'd been rehearsing with her understudy at the hotel, and that she never even heard of this Mr. Faulkner, and the sergeant said, Miss Hel—" She stopped and flushed. "Miss Hellman," suggested Sir Henry with a twinkle. "Oh, yes, yes, that would do, thank you. He said, 'Well, Miss Hellman, I felt it must be some mistake, knowing that you were stopping at the Bridge Hotel.' And he said, 'Would I have any objection to confronting?' Or was it being confronted? I can't remember."
"Doesn't matter," said Sir Henry reassuringly.
"Anyway, with a young man. So I said, 'Of course not.' And they brought him in and said, 'This is Miss Hellyer.' And..." "Oh," Jane broke off, open-mouthed.
"Never mind, my dear," said Miss Marple consolingly. "We were bound to guess, you know. And you haven't given us the name of the place or anything that really matters."
"Well," said Jane, "I did mean to tell it as though it happened to someone else, but it is difficult, isn't it? I mean, one forgets so."
Everyone assured her that it was very difficult, and soothed and reassured, she went on with her slightly involved narrative.
"He was a nice-looking man. Quite a nice-looking man, young, with reddish hair, and his mouth just opened when he saw me, and the sergeant said, 'Is this the lady?' And he said, 'No, indeed it isn't. What an ass I've been.' And I smiled at him and said it didn't matter."
"I can picture the scene," said Sir Henry.
Jane Hellyer frowned. "Let me see. How had I better go on?"
"Supposing you tell us what it was all about, dear," said Miss Marple, so mildly that no one could suspect her of irony. "I mean, what the young man's mistake was, and about the burglary."
"Oh, yes," said Jane. "Well, you see, this young man, Leslie Faulkner, his name was, had written a play. He'd written several plays, as a matter of fact, though none of them had ever been taken, and he had sent this particular play to me to read. I didn't know about it, because, of course, I have hundreds of plays sent to me, and I read very few of them myself, only the ones I know something about. Anyway, there it was, and it seems that Mr. Faulkner got a letter from me. And it turned out not to be really from me. You understand?"
She paused anxiously, and they assured her they understood.
saying that I'd read the play and liked it very much, and would he come down and talk it over with me, and it gave the address, the Bungalow Riverbury. So Mr. Faulkner was frightfully pleased, and he came down and arrived at this place, the Bungalow. A parlour maid opened the door, and he asked for Miss Hellyer, and she said Miss Hellyer was in and expecting him, and showed him into the drawing-room. And there a woman came to him, and he accepted her as me, as a matter of course. It seems queer, because after all he had seen me act, my photographs are very well known, aren't they? "Over the length and breadth of England," said Mrs. Bantry promptly, "but there's often a lot of difference between a photograph and its original, my dear Jane, and there's a great deal of difference between behind the footlights and off the stage. It's not every actress who stands a test as well as you do, remember?" "Well," said Jane, slightly mollified, "that may be so. Anyway, he described this woman as tall and fair, with big blue eyes and very good-looking, so I suppose it must have been near enough. He certainly had no suspicions." She sat down and began talking about his play, and said she was anxious to do it. Whilst they were talking, cocktails were brought in, and Mr. Faulkner had one as a matter of course. Well, that's all he remembers, having his cocktail. When he woke up, or came to himself, or whatever you call it, he was lying out in the road, by the hedge, of course, so that there would be no danger of his being run over. He felt very queer and shaky. So much so that he just got up and staggered along the road, not quite knowing where he was going. He said if he'd had any senses about him, he'd have gone back to the bungalow and tried to find out what had happened, but he just felt stupid and mazed and walked along without quite knowing what he was doing. He was just more or less coming to himself when the police arrested him. "Why did the police arrest him?" asked Dr. Lloyd. "Oh, didn't I tell you?" said Jane, opening her eyes very wide. "Oh, how very stupid I am. The burglary."
"You mentioned a burglary, but you didn't say where or what or why," said Mrs. Bantry.
"Well, this bungalow, the one he went to, of course, it wasn't mine at all. It belonged to a man whose name was—"
Again Jane furrowed her brows.
"Do you want me to be godfather again?" asked Sir Henry. "Pseudonym supplied free of charge. Describe the tenant, and I'll do the naming." It was taken by a rich city man, a knight."
"Sir Herman Cohen," suggested Sir Henry.
"Oh, that will do beautifully. He took it for a lady. She was the wife of an actor, and she was also an actress herself."
"We'll call the actor Claude Leeson," said Sir Henry, "and the lady would be known by her stage name, I suppose, so we'll call her Miss Mary Carr."
"I think you're awfully clever," said Jane. "I don't know how you think of these things so easily. Well, you see, this was sort of a weekend cottage for Sir Herman, did you say Herman, and the lady. And, of course, his wife knew nothing about it."
"Which is so often the case," said Sir Henry.
"And he'd given this actress woman a good deal of jewellery, including some very fine emeralds."
"Ah," said Dr. Lloyd, "now we're getting at it.
This jewellery was at the bungalow, just locked up in a jewel case. The police said it was very careless. Anyone might have taken it."
"You see, Dolly," said Colonel Bantry, "what do I always tell you?"
"Well, in my experience," said Mrs. Bantry, "it's always the people who are so dreadfully careful who lose things. I don't lock mine up in a jewel case. I keep it in a drawer loose under my stockings. I dare say Mary Carr done the same thing, it would never have been stolen."
"It would," said Jane, "because all the drawers are burst open and the contents strewn about."
"But they weren't really looking for jewels," said Mrs. Bantry. "They were looking for secret papers. That's what always happens in books."
"I don't know about secret papers," said Jane doubtfully. "I never heard of any."
"Don't be distracted, Miss Hellyer," said Colonel Bantry. "Dolly's wild red herrings are not to be taken seriously."
"About the burglary," said Sir Henry.
"Yes, well, the police were rung up by someone who said that she was Miss Mary Carr. She said the bungalow had been burgled and described a young man with red hair who'd called there that morning. Her maid had thought there was something odd about him and had refused him admittance, but later they'd seen him getting out through a window. She described the man so accurately that the police arrested him only an hour later, and then he told his story and showed them the letter from me. And as I told you, they fetched me, and when he saw me, he said what I told you, that it hadn't been me at all."
"A very curious story," said Dr. Lloyd. "Did Mr. Faulkner know this, Miss Carr?"
"No, he didn't."
"Or said he didn't.
But I haven't told you the most curious part yet. The police went to the bungalow, of course, and they found everything as described. Drawers pulled out and jewels gone, but the whole place was empty. It wasn't till some hours later that Mary Carr came back, and when she did, she said she'd never rung them up at all, and this was the first she'd heard of it. It seemed that she had had a wire that morning from a manager offering her a most important part and making an appointment, so she'd naturally rushed up to town to keep it. When she got there, she found that the whole thing was a hoax. No telegram had ever been sent. "A common enough ruse to get her out of the way," commented Sir Henry. "What about the servants?" "The same sort of thing happened there. There was only one. She was rung up on the telephone, apparently by Mary Carr, who said she left a most important thing behind. She directed the maid to bring up a certain handbag which was in the drawer of her bedroom. She was to catch the first train. The maid did so, of course, locking up the house. But when she arrived at Miss Carr's club, where she'd been told to meet her mistress, she waited there in vain." Said Sir Henry, "I begin to see. The house was left empty, and to make an entry by one of the windows would present few difficulties, I should imagine. But I don't quite see where this Mr. Faulkner comes in. Who did ring up the police if it wasn't Miss Carr?" "That's what nobody knew or ever found out." "Curious," said Sir Henry. "Did the young man turn out to be genuinely the person he said he was?" "Oh, yes, that part of it was all right. He'd even got the letter, which was supposed to be written by me. It wasn't the least bit like my handwriting. But then, of course, he couldn't be supposed to know that." "Well, let's state the position clearly," said Sir Henry. "Correct me if I go wrong. The lady and the maid are decoyed from the house. The young man is decoyed down there by means of a bogus letter, colour being lent to this last by the fact that you actually are performing at Riverbury that week. The young man is doped, and the police are rung up and have their suspicions directed against him. A burglary actually has taken place. I presume the jewels were taken."
"Oh, yes. Were they ever recovered?"
"No, never, I think. As a matter of fact, Sir Herman tried to hush things up all he knew how, but he couldn't manage it. And I rather fancy his wife started divorce proceedings in consequence. Still, I don't really know about that."
"What happened to Mr. Leslie Faulkner?"
"He was released in the end. The police said they hadn't really got enough against him. Don't you think the whole thing was rather odd?"
"Distinctly odd.
The first question is whose story to believe?" "In telling it, Miss Hellyer, I notice that you incline towards believing Mr. Faulkner. Have you any reason for doing so, beyond your own instinct in the matter?"
"No," said Jane unwillingly, "I suppose I haven't. But he was so very nice and so apologetic for having mistaken anyone else for me that I feel sure he must mean telling the truth."
"I see," said Sir Henry, smiling, "but you must admit that he could have invented the story quite easily. He could write the letter purporting to be from you himself. He could also dope himself after successfully committing the burglary. But I confess I don't see where the point of all that would be. Easier to enter the house, help himself, and disappear quietly, unless just possibly he was observed by someone in the neighbourhood, and knew himself to have been observed. Then he might hastily concoct this plan for diverting suspicion from himself and accounting for his presence in the neighbourhood."
"Was he well off?"
asked Miss Marple.
"I don't think so," said Jane. "No, I believe he was rather hard up."
"The whole thing seems curious," said Dr. Lloyd. "I must confess that if we accept the young man's story as true, it seems to make the case much more difficult. Why should the unknown woman who pretended to be Miss Hellyer drag this unknown man into the affair? Why should she stage such an elaborate comedy?"
"Tell me, Jane," said Mrs. Bantry, "did young Faulkner ever come face to face with Mary Carr at any stage of the proceedings?"
"I don't quite know," said Jane slowly, as she puzzled her brows in remembrance.
"Because if he didn't, the case is solved," said Mrs. Bantry. "I'm sure I'm right. What is easier than to pretend you're called up to town? You telephone to your maid from Paddington, or whatever station you arrive at, and as she comes up to town, you go down again. The young man calls by appointment. He's doped. You set the stage for the burglary, overdoing it as much as possible. You telephone the police, giving a description of your scapegoat, and off you go to town again. Then you arrive home by a later train and do the surprised innocent."
"But why should she steal her own jewels, Dolly?"
"They always do," said Mrs. Bantry. "Anyway, I can think of hundreds of reasons. She may have wanted money at once. Old Sir Herman wouldn't give her cash, perhaps, so she pretends the jewels are stolen and then sells them secretly. Or she may have been being blackmailed by someone who threatened to tell her husband or Sir Herman's wife. Or she may have already sold the jewels, and Sir Herman was getting ratty and asking to see them, so she had to do something about it. That's done a good deal in books. Or perhaps she was going to have them reset, and she'd got paste replicas. Or, now here's a very good idea, and not so much done in books. She pretends they're stolen, gets in an awful state, and he gives her a fresh lot, so she gets two lots instead of one. That kind of woman, I'm sure, is most frightfully artful. "You are clever, Dolly," said Jane admiringly. "I never thought of that." "You may be clever, but she doesn't say you're right," said Colonel Bantry. "I'm inclined to suspicion of the City gentleman. He'd know the sort of telegram to get the lady out of the way, and he could manage the rest easily enough with the help of a new lady friend. Nobody seems to have thought of asking him for an alibi." "What do you think, Miss Marple?" asked Jane, turning towards the old lady, who had sat silent, a puzzled frown on her face. "My dear, I really don't know what to say. Sir Henry will laugh, but I recall no village parallel to help me this time. Of course, there are several questions that suggest themselves. For instance, the servant question. In, well, an irregular menage of the kind you describe, the servant employed would doubtless be perfectly aware of the state of things, and a really nice girl would not take such a place. Her mother wouldn't let her for a minute. So I think we can assume that the maid was not a really trustworthy character. She may have been in league with the thieves. She would leave the house open for them, and actually go to London, as though sure of the pretense telephone message, so as to divert suspicion from herself. I must confess that that seems the most probable solution. Only if ordinary thieves were concerned, it seems very odd. It seems to argue more knowledge than the maid-servant was likely to have. Miss Marple paused, and then went on dreamily. I can't help feeling that there was some, well, what I must describe as personal feeling about the whole thing. Supposing somebody had a spite, for instance. Don't you think that that would explain things better, and a deliberate attempt to get him into trouble? That's what it looks like. And yet, that's not entirely satisfactory. "Why, Doctor, you haven't said anything," said Jane. "I'd forgotten you." "I'm always getting forgotten," said the grizzled doctor sadly. "I must have a very inconspicuous personality." "Oh, no," said Jane. "Do tell us what you think." "I'm rather in the position of agreeing with everyone's solutions, and yet with none of them. I myself have a far-fetched and probably totally erroneous theory that the wife may have had something to do with it. Sir Herman's wife, I mean. I've no grounds for thinking so, only you would be surprised if you knew the extraordinary things that a wronged wife will take it into her head to do." "Oh, Dr. Lloyd," cried Miss Marple excitedly, "how clever of you! And I never thought of poor Mrs. Pebmarsh." Jane stared at her. "Mrs. Pebmarsh? Who is Mrs. Pebmarsh?" "Well," Miss Marple hesitated, "I don't know that she really comes in. She's a laundress, and she stole an opal pin that was pinned into a blouse and put it in another woman's house." Jane looked more fogged than ever. "And that makes it all perfectly clear to you, Miss Marple," said Sir Henry with a twinkle. But to his surprise, Miss Marple shook her head. "No, no, I'm afraid it doesn't. I must confess myself completely at a loss. What I do realize is that women must stick together. One should, in an emergency, stand by one's own sex. I think that's the moral of the story Miss Hellyer has told us." "I must confess that that particular ethical significance of the mystery has escaped me," said Sir Henry gravely. "Perhaps I shall see the significance of your point more clearly when Miss Hellyer has revealed the solution." "Eh," said Jane, looking rather bewildered. "I was observing that in childish language we give it up. You and you alone, Miss Hellyer, have had the high honour of presenting such an absolutely baffling mystery that even Miss Marple has to confess herself defeated." "You all give it up?" asked Jane.
"Yes."
After a minute's silence, during which he waited for the others to speak, Sir Henry constituted himself spokesman once more. "That is to say, we stand or fall by the sketchy solutions we have tentatively advanced. One each for the mere men, two for Miss Marple, and a round dozen for Mrs. B. It was not a dozen, said Mrs. Bantry. They were variations on a main theme. And how often am I to tell you that I will not be called Mrs. B? So you all give up, said Jane thoughtfully. That's very interesting. She leant back in her chair and began to polish her nails rather absent-mindedly. Well, said Mrs. Bantry, come on, Jane, what's the solution? The solution? Yes, what really happened? Jane stared at her. I haven't the least idea.
What?
I've always wondered. I thought you were all so clever, one of you would be able to tell me. Everybody harboured feelings of annoyance. It was all very well for Jane to be so beautiful, but at the moment everyone felt that stupidity could be carried too far. Even the most transcendent loveliness could not excuse it.
You mean the truth was never discovered, said Sir Henry.
No. That's why, as I say, I did think that you would be able to tell me.
Jane sounded injured. It was plain that she felt she'd had a grievance.
Well, I'm, said Colonel Bantry, words failing him. You are the most aggravating girl, Jane, said his wife. Anyway, I'm sure on all Shelby that I was right. If you just tell us the proper names of all the people, I shall be quite sure.
Don't think I could do that, said Jane slowly.
No, dear, said Miss Marple. Miss Hellier couldn't do that.
Of course she could, said Mrs. Bantry. Don't be so high-minded, Jane. We older folks must have a bit of scandal. At any rate, tell us who the city magnate was.
But Jane shook her head, and Miss Marple, in her old-fashioned way, continued to support the girl. It must have been a very distressing business, she said.
No, said Jane truthfully, I think I rather enjoyed it.
Well, perhaps you did, said Miss Marple. I suppose it was a break in the monotony. What play were you acting in?
Smith!
Oh, yes, that's one of Mr. Somerset Maugham's, isn't it? All his are very clever, I think. I've seen them nearly all.
You're reviving it to go on tour next autumn, aren't you? Asked Mrs. Bantry.
Jane nodded. "Well," said Miss Marple, rising, "I must go home. Such late hours. But we've had a very entertaining evening, most unusually so. I think Miss Hellier's story wins the prize. Don't you agree?"
"I'm sorry you're angry with me," said Jane, "about not knowing the end, I mean. I suppose I should have said so sooner."
Her tone sounded wistful. Dr. Lloyd rose gallantly to the occasion.
"My dear young lady, why should you? You gave us a very pretty problem to sharpen our wits upon. I'm only sorry we none of us could solve it convincingly."
"Speak for yourself," said Mrs. Bantry. "I did solve it. I'm convinced I'm right."
"Do you know, I really believe you are," said Jane. "What you said sounded so probable."
"Which of her seven solutions do you refer to?" asked Sir Henry teasingly.
Dr. Lloyd gallantly assisted Miss Marple to put on her galoshes. "Just in case," as the old lady explained. The doctor was to be her escort to her old-world cottage. Wrapped in several woollen shawls, Miss Marple wished everyone good night once more. She came to Jane Hellier last, and, leaning forward, she murmured something in the actress's ear. A startled, "Oh!" burst from Jane, so loud as to cause the others to turn their heads. Smiling and nodding, Miss Marple made her exit. Jane Hellier stared after her.
"Are you coming to bed, Jane?" asked Mrs. Bantry. "What's the matter with you? You're staring as though you'd seen a ghost."
With a deep sigh, Jane came to herself. She had a beautiful and bewildering smile on the two men and followed her hostess up the staircase. Mrs. Bantry came into the girl's room with her.
"Your fire's nearly out," said Mrs. Bantry, giving it a vicious and ineffectual poke. "They can't have made it up properly. How stupid housemaids are still! I suppose we are rather late tonight. Why, it's actually past 1 o'clock.
"Do you think there are many people like her?" asked Jane Hellier. She was sitting on the side of the bed, apparently wrapped in thought.
"Like the housemaid?"
"No. Like that funny old woman. What's her name? Marple."
"Oh, I don't know. I suppose she's a fairly common type in a small village."
"Oh, dear," said Jane, "I don't know what to do." She sighed deeply.
"What's the matter?"
"I'm worried."
What about?
Dolly, Jane Hellyer was portentously solemn, do you know what that queer old lady whispered to me before she went out of the door tonight?
No, what?
She said, I shouldn't do it if I were you, my dear. Never put yourself too much in another woman's power, even if you think she's your friend at the moment.
You know, Dolly, that's awfully true.
The maxim, yes, perhaps it is, but I don't see the application.
I suppose you can't ever really trust a woman, and I should be in her power. I never thought of that.
What woman are you talking about?
Netta Green, my understudy.
What on earth does Miss Marple know about your understudy?
I suppose she guessed, but I can't see how.
Jane, will you kindly tell me at once what you're talking about?
The story.
The one I told you.
Oh, Dolly, that woman, you know, the one that took Claude from me.
Mrs. Bantry nodded, casting her mind back rapidly to the first of Jane's unfortunate marriages, to Claude Averbury, the actor.
He married her. I could have told him how it would be.
Claude doesn't know, but she's carrying on with Sir Joseph Salmon.
Weekends with him at the bungalow I told you about.
I wanted her shown up. I'd like everyone to know the sort of woman she was, and you see, with a burglary, everything would be bound to come out.
Jane, gasped Mrs. Bantry, did you engineer this story you've been telling us?
Jane nodded.
That's why I chose Smith. I wear parlourmaid's kit in it, you know, so I should have it handy. And when they sent for me to the police station, it's the easiest thing in the world to say I was rehearsing my part of my understudy at the hotel. Really, of course, we would be at the bungalow. I just have to open the door and bring in the cocktails, and Netta to pretend to be me. He'd never see her again, of course, so there would be no fear of his recognising her. And I can make myself look quite different as a parlourmaid, and besides, one doesn't look at parlourmaids as though they were people. We plan to drag him out into the road afterwards, bag the jewel case, telephone the police, and get back to the hotel. I shouldn't like the poor young man to suffer, but Sir Henry didn't seem to think he would, did he? And she'd be in the papers and everything, and Claude would see what she was really like. Mrs. Bantry sat down and groaned. Oh, my poor head, and all the time... Jane Hellyer, you deceitful girl, telling us that story the way you did.
I am a good actress, said Jane complacently. I always have been, whatever people choose to say. I didn't give myself away once, did I?
Miss Marple was right, murmured Mrs. Bantry, the personal element. Oh, yes, the personal element. Jane, my good child, you realise that theft is theft, and you might have been sent to prison.
Well, none of you guessed, said Jane.
Except Miss Marple.
The worried expression returned to her face.
Dolly, do you really think there are many like her?
Frankly, I don't, said Mrs. Bantry.
Jane sighed again. Oh, well, still one had better not risk it, and of course I should be in Netta's power, that's true enough. She might turn against me or blackmail me or anything. She helped me think out the details, and she professed to be devoted to me, but one never does know with women. No, I think Miss Marple's right. I'd better not risk it.
But, my dear, you have risked it.
Oh, no, Jane opened her blue eyes very wide. Don't you understand? None of this has happened yet. I was, well, trying it on the dog, so to speak.
I don't profess to understand your theatrical slang, said Mrs. Bantry with dignity.
Do you mean this is a future project, not a past deed?
I was going to do it this autumn, in September.
I don't know what to do now.
And Jane Marple guessed, actually guessed the truth and never told us, said Mrs. Bantry wrathfully.
I think that was why she said about women sticking together. She wouldn't give me away before the men. That was nice of her. I don't mind your knowing, Dolly.
Well, give the idea up. Jane, I beg of you.
I think I shall, murmured Miss Hellyer. There might be other Miss Marples.
End of Disc 5.